Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel, a journalist. That was Celia, for those of you listening online. And I'll be your moderator for today's program called Troubled Turkey. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to listen online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. To my immediate left is Mahir Zeynalov. He's a Washington, D.C.-based Turkish journalist and analyst. Next to him is Jeffrey Collins, a former White House National Security Staff Director for Turkish Affairs. And then on the far left is Dr. Banefşe Kenuş, the foreign affairs expert and the author of Saudi Arabia and Iran, Friends or Foes. Our distinguished panel will discuss the unsettled situation in Turkey that transpired after the coup attempt in July, and also the tightening of control in Turkey by President Erdogan. We're going to start first with Mahir, who is a good person to start. He's a prominent journalist and analyst. He was deported from Turkey in 2014. He is under arrest in Turkey. His former paper, Zaman, has been shut down, and he is going to give us a pretty good overview, I'd say, of the situation in Turkey and also present partly his personal feelings about the situation there. Mahir.
Thank you very much. This is working, right? Everyone can hear me? No, it's not working. I'm not sure. Okay. All right, great. Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. please stop me if I exceed my time. Actually, I was kicked out of Turkey for speaking too much, so there's that danger. Well, I was fixing our house's sewage because that's what journalists do when they are deported from their countries. Then I heard my telephone was exploding from calls and messages and all these mentions on Twitter and comments on Facebook. And I just wondering, what did I do wrong this time again? And when I looked through my Twitter account, I saw that the President Erdogan, he was prime minister back then, who called me a liar while speaking in the parliament, and people were just cheering. I really wondered what really happened. He just called me someone who is using in every way possible to lie to people. Just 5 days before that incident, I was called into police in Istanbul for questioning, and I was going to the police station with my lawyer, and there was a prosecutor who would just ask questions about why I wrote the article that I did. And then, of course, I was worried. I'm not a criminal or thug. I'd never been in a police station being, interrogated by the police chief and the prosecutor. So I went there, and then my lawyer was trying to calm me down. I've done this many times. I know how it works. And I was asking, am I going to jail from here? It's like, no way. It's just normal proceeding. So I went to the police station, and they asked me, why did you write this article? And I threw my editors under the bus. I said that my editors asked me. Actually, the editor was me. So that's what journalists do, right? Spin the stories. Well, then I listed down all these treaties that Turkey is party to that protects freedom of press, freedom of speech, and then I left that place. A month before that, I shared an article about the corruption scandal, twin corruption investigations that targeted Prime Minister Erdogan and people in his inner circle. And on that night, the Turkish media outlets, loyalist media, launched tremendous, massive smear campaign against me. And just imagine, one of the headlines was, there was my photo with arrows, to my head, saying that Turkey, beware of this traitor. Just imagine that you're a journalist in a country whose leader is widely popular, and those pro-Erdogan media is just targeting you. And just a month before that, we knew that it was very dangerous for me to walk in the streets. Whenever I hugged goodbye to my wife when I left home in the morning for work, we really had that hidden thought in our minds that I would never be able to come back again. And one morning, it just happened. 16 years before that incident, Erdogan himself was jailed for reciting a poem that disturbed military-backed judiciary back then. He used the exact same penal code article to press charges against me, seeking up to 6 years in jail. And I was one of the lucky ones who was actually kicked out of Turkey before they could put me in jail. That shows what kind of transformation President Erdogan took back in 1990 to 2014 as he significantly escalated the crackdown, especially in the past 3 months. As I said, I'm one of the lucky ones. I have nearly 80 colleagues from the same newsroom who are in jail at the moment. There are 144 journalists imprisoned. These are the colleagues that I ask questions to officials during press conferences. These are the colleagues that we rush stories in the same newsroom. These are the people that were tear gassed during the Gezi demonstrations in 2003 summer protests, anti-government protests. And I can only imagine what they're going through at the moment in prison. You know, they're not criminals or thugs who can just stay in a solitary confinement. I just received several letters from some of my colleagues, some of the journalists that I work together, and they're just saying that, you know, they are not allowed to meet with their lawyers. They are not even allowed to read a book. And that's actually one of the tactics of Hitler against those Jewish intellectuals. They were just putting them in one single room, one single cell, and giving them nothing. No notebook, no nothing. So I can only imagine what they're going through there. And, you know, for journalists, being jailed is a career-advancing, you know, opportunity experience. And I've always wondered that what it would look like if I go to, you know, jail. I've never seen inside of the jail, so I don't know how it looks like. But because, you know, we journalists read a lot, but most of them are trash. It's just, you know, newspaper articles, you know, magazine articles just disappears the next day. So I really wanted to read a book. And I thought that, you know, a prison would be a good place to read a book or perhaps a write one. I hope my wife is not listening to this because she's going to be very angry to what I say here. But, you know, when I escaped the police, I went to the newsroom on that day in February 2014, and my editor-in-chief told me that, you know, you are wanted for arrest and the police are coming for you. They stormed my house, and they were coming to the newsroom, and I was hiding in the newsroom, thinking that, of course, the police would not, you know, raid our newsroom. It's funny when I say this, because 2 years later, they just completely shut down the newspaper. The riot police stormed it, and it doesn't exist now. It was the largest, you know, newspaper in Turkey. So when we heard that the police are after me, my editors, you know, took me out from the behind door, went to a safe location. It was just one room. It was not a hotel, but it was a one room, like a hotel room. And you are there, and there's nothing. There's only just one bottle of water, and I stayed there for 3 days. And you just do nothing. It's so boring that you just, you know, just counting the patterns on the wall, or just you are sleeping for 2 hours, waking up and thinking. So I can imagine what they're going through. I have a friend, an academic in Brussels, who told me that her father is in jail, and he's a professor of 30 years. He was evicted from his house. He's one of the more than 1,000 academics at the moment that were jailed. Only this morning when I woke up, I saw that the Turkish court issued an arrest warrant for 103 academics, and more than 70 of them are already imprisoned. I think that the rest is abroad in exile now. The scale, the massive purge is so big, so immense, that perhaps this is the largest the world has seen in decades. More than 120,000 people have been purged, dismissed, or sacked in the past 3 months because we have the state of emergency rule. Erdogan is ruling by decrees. More than 80,000 people have been detained. Half of them were arrested pending trial, including journalists, academics, members of the judiciary, police, military officers, doctors, including soccer referees. And most of them were charged with ludicrous, you know, charges. They were like downloading an iPhone app, or, you know, having a $1 bill, which prosecutors claim that the serial numbers is a secret code sent from the United States, or subscribing to our newspaper, or having a bank account in a bank that was affiliated with the Gulen movement. So when you consider how they cast their net too wide and how they are overstretching. They are not only cracking down on the Gulen movement that Erdogan sees as a rival, but also to other groups too. Just when I came here 2 weeks ago, they shut down 15 Kurdish media outlets. They detained, and now they are in prison, 13 lawmakers from the Turkish third opposition party, which is pro-Kurdish. They raided the newspaper, secular opposition newspaper called Cumhuriyet, and now 13 of their journalists and senior officials are in jail at the moment. Erdogan is targeting Kurdish groups in the southeastern Turkey, reducing those Kurdish towns and districts to rubble, and there are hundreds of thousands of people who fled for their lives. More than 2,000 people were killed in the southeastern Turkey. And in foreign policy too, Erdogan is targeting a Kurdish group called YPG, which is the most effective ground forces partnered with the United States in its fight against ISIS in northern Syria. Erdogan is already threatening to join a critical operation around Mosul in which they try to flush out the ISIS militants. He has been acting erratically both at home and abroad. I think he needs that because as he goes to a referendum in constitutional changes referendum in April, he desperately needs the nationalist votes, and he has to target the Kurdish groups both at home and abroad, and war at home and abroad also is a perfect reason for him to extend the emergency rule, which he said he can, which was a blessing that he can do whatever he wants. When you look at the crackdown in the past several years, I think we had like 4,000, around 4,000 people were arrested in the past 3 years. As part of this crackdown, most of them are political dissidents. But since the coup 4 months ago, 80,000 people have been detained. And Erdogan called, it's in his words, called the military coup attempt as a gift from God that will allow him to clean the army and further consolidate his power. I try to paint a broader picture of what's going on in Turkey. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. There's a lot more to ask about that, a lot more follow-up questions. But in the meantime, though, we'll hear from Jeffrey Collins, who, as I said earlier, is a former White House National Security Staff Director for Turkish Affairs, spent a lot of time in Turkey and has spent a lot of time in the region at large, Iraq, et cetera. So, Jeffrey.
Thank you. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for having me, Jonathan, my esteemed panelists, and Celia for all you do to advance the discussion on Middle East issues. So every time I'm invited to talk about Turkey, it seems like it's following a crisis. It was the Gezi Park protests in 2013. It was the Erdogan-Fethullah Gulen split in 2014, which Mahir just referenced. But I think today what we're here to talk about is something of far greater magnitude. I'm going to touch on some issues around U.S.-Turkish bilateral relations. So U.S.-Turkish relations had already been sinking during the last 2 years over Syria and ISIS. Following the July 15th coup attempt, relations have sunk even lower, and I would argue that they're the worst they've been in several decades. So following the coup attempt, as you just heard, President Erdogan has essentially suspended rule of law in Turkey and led a purge without precedent. So the purge began with Gulenis. That's no surprise. Erdogan, over 10 years, had consolidated power, taking on the military, the state apparatus, and really his last remaining enemy was his one-time ally, Fethullah Gulen. So that was no surprise. I think what was more surprising to Turkey followers was the expansion of the purges to Kurds, Alevis, journalists, dissidents, and it's come to the point today, which Mahir also just touched on, where any critical thinker, including many of my own friends who are academics and human rights experts, they're at risk. There's no due process, there's no rule of law. And I think what we're beginning to see is an exodus out of Turkey of brain power. And I think this brain drain, if it doesn't stop, is going to be the start of something larger that will affect the Turkish economy and foreign direct investment. So with that said, how is the U.S. involved in these events around the coup attempt in July? So it might be news to some of you, But most Turks believe the U.S. is behind the coup attempt in Turkey. Immediately following the coup, Erdogan and the Turkish media, which is largely now controlled by Erdogan, they fed the narrative that Gulen orchestrated the coup. Now, there was some evidence that that was true, but we now know that the reality is more complex. The Gulen, there was Gulen community involvement, but we've seen evidence that it was a coalition that included secular nationalists and even some AKP members who may have tacitly accepted what was happening. And today, Turkish opinion polls show that 65 to 90% of Turks believe that Gulen and the Gulen community orchestrated, arranged, carried out the coup. But at the same time, Erdogan and the Turkish media openly accused the U.S. of being behind the coup. And what they did from the day after the coup on was they really just fed blatant lies to the Turkish public. They started with something I know you're familiar with. One of my good friends, Henri Barki, who's a professor, policy expert of American of Turkish descent, happened to organize a conference from July 15th to 17th outside of Istanbul. And because it coincided with the day of the coup attempt, Erdogan blamed Henri for starting the coup. And to those of us who know him, it was just incredibly ludicrous. So I think to those who follow Turkey, this blaming of the U.S. was also not surprising. The Turkish psyche has been scarred by years of foreign interventions in Ottoman lands, and we all know it's susceptible to conspiracy theories. So what Erdogan was doing was really just playing into this, drumming up domestic support to use as cover for the purges. So let me now touch on bilateral U.S.-Turkish relations. What has the Obama administration done about the breakdown of rule of law and the campaign to malign the U.S.? And what might happen under President-elect Trump? So let's start with Obama. It's really somewhat of a sad tale what has happened with bilateral relations under Obama. He came into office with high hopes for U.S.-Turkish relations. He felt that the U.S. had overlooked a majority Muslim democratic nation, and he made his first bilateral overseas visit to Turkey. It was a huge symbolic visit. Now, the relationship got off to a good start, but then it had ups and downs over the following years. There was a rocky period following the Mavi Marmara incident, which some of you are probably familiar with, and when Turkey voted no on UN sanctions in the UN Security Council, Iran sanctions, excuse me. Following that, there was a very positive period in relations, 2010 to 2011. One policy scholar has called it the golden era of recent U.S.-Turkish relations, and I'm proud that that actually coincided with my time there. President Obama and Prime Minister Erdogan at the time coordinated immensely on a number of different issues involving NATO and the Middle East. But then things spiraled downward, beginning in the Arab Spring, over disagreements between President Obama and Prime Minister Erdogan over how to treat the coup in Egypt. Things worsened during the Syrian civil war. Erdogan wanted the U.S. to support and to send in arms and to send in support of militias to overthrow Assad, and of course, the U.S. did not want to do that. So that brings us to the coup attempt and the post-coup. What's happened is the U.S. has essentially made very weak pronouncements of concern about these purges, but otherwise they haven't done anything, and I would argue that they've essentially taken themselves out of the policy picture. And the effect of this, I believe, is that it enables Erdogan. Erdogan only respects and listens to very strong leaders. And we've seen this play out with Putin and Bibi. Turkey is normalizing relations with those two countries now, and that is not a surprise because both those leaders stood up to Erdogan. So might President-elect Trump turn things around? I think on the surface, he starts from a good position. So he seemingly has the ability to stand up to President Erdogan. And he cheered Erdogan's success in putting down the coup. He made no mention, of course, of human rights concerns. Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, rumored to be the eventual NSA, has lobbied for government of Turkey-affiliated groups. And Erdogan, in response to the U.S. election, said he thinks this is the start of a new era for U.S.-Turkish relations. So again, on the surface, it might seem like things might change, but I believe that these are superficial signs, and what we will see is that these will not translate into a true strategic partnership, but instead we'll see a transactional relationship. I'll give you something if you give me something. And I'm just going to touch on three issues to watch and then conclude. So the first is the extradition of Fethullah Gulen. This is a key point for Erdogan. He's pushing very hard for it. And General Flynn called for Gulen to be extradited, and he called the Hizmet schools, the charter schools that are part of the Gulen community in the U.S. and around the world, a scam. But the reality is the extradition process is very complex. Gulen is represented by a very high-profile white-collar attorney at Steptoe and Johnson in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be difficult for Trump to just extradite him. I think what's more likely is that Trump will influence the FBI to broaden its investigation into the charter schools. The next two issues, I think, are a bit more troublesome. So the first is ISIS. So Erdogan wants the U.S. to end support of the Syrian Kurds, the PYD, which Mahir referred to, who are part of the anti-ISIS coalition. Ankara sees the PYD as linked to the terrorist PKK. And although Flynn has said Turkey is our strongest ally in the fight against ISIS, Trump himself has expressed strong support for the Kurds, as have many Republicans. I think it's unlikely Trump will abandon the Kurds. And then that brings me to Syria, which of course is interrelated. Erdogan wants the U.S. to support the Free Syrian Army. These are the moderate Islamic rebels trying to overthrow Assad. But Trump has suggested he would cut aid to the Free Syrian Army. He doesn't seem to distinguish between different strains of Islam, moderate Islam versus more extreme Islam. Well, Turkey does. Turkey supports the Muslim Brotherhood, as an example. And Trump has suggested he might work with Putin, which would be tacitly supporting Assad, and that is a deal breaker for Erdogan. So I think those three things are signs that this will be a challenging relationship. To conclude, I think it's clear that Turkey will remain critical for the U.S. It's long been a crucial NATO ally. We just have to look at the map to see its neighborhood and the importance of where it sits for our strategic issues, Iran, Iraq, Syria. But Turkey is complex, and to me, it's unclear that Trump and a Trump administration will be able to navigate its nuances. Ultimately, I think that Trump and Erdogan, I think their personalities, as I said, will lead to a transactional relationship. And unfortunately, in my view, this will overlook long-term strategic interests, which very importantly include rule of law and human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey Collins. Again, to remind our listening audience, former White House National Security Staff Director for Turkish Affairs. And next, we're going to hear from Dr. Banavşe Kinuş, foreign affairs expert and author of Saudi Arabia and Iran, Friends or Foes. Dr. Kinuş.
Thank you, Jonathan Curiel, and also my co-panelists, Mahir Zeynalov and Jeffrey Collins. It's disconcerting to watch Turkey struggle with its foreign and domestic policy, but it might help to put things in perspective in this fray, so that this struggle, to understand that this struggle is actually nothing new for Turkey. Domestically, Turkey has long been known as having a strong state and a weak government. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to redress that But he and every other Turkish leader before him has been mired in waves of domestic political purges resulting from a struggle between Islamic parties and the military, followed by the resurging of civil society. Regionally, Turkey is always influenced by a surge of Islamism in the region. When the Arabs waged war on Israel and the rise of pro-Palestinian Islamism followed, Islamism in Turkey surged. Turkey's current tensions with the Arabs for Turkey's empathizing with the Muslim Brotherhood and its simultaneous influence over Islamic forces fighting in Syria are the direct product of Islamism in the Arab world. And since 1923, which is when Turkey basically established the fundamentals of its modern statehood as a secular state, this has also ended up challenging the secular nature of Turkey. Likewise, Turkey has had a Kurdish issue since 1923 in its borders and in the region. Internationally, Turkey has always tried to assert independence in its dealings with big powers. In 1923, again, it refused to budge over territorial concessions, unless so for very pragmatic reasons, say over Mosul, in return for some territory along its borders with Syria. After feeling mistakenly drawn into the Korean War, it carved its independent path over Cyprus, irrespective of NATO and the United States. While pushing for inclusion with Europe, it has always insisted on its own terms. During the 2000 Iraq invasion, it refused to cooperate with the United States. Overall, it seems that Turkey is inclined to operate, to me at least, like an elastic band, overstretching, then retrenching, and then readjusting, and its Syria policy is a prime example. The key question is what gives Turkey this ability to operate within a relatively wide margin of error. Turkey has long been considered an important but marginal state relative to the rest of the Middle East. In fact, I see Turkish politics shadowing the major regional trends at all times. And if you speak to the regional countries, they see it the same way, more or less. Turkey is considered a strategic partner for everyone in the region because it is and aims to be, since its new formation, a predictable status quo state. Despite current displays of seemingly ambitious policies, Turkey has been far less disruptive to the region than one assumes. And if you look carefully, Turkey is never a steady ally for anyone, either in any significantly prolonged preferential manner, unless it is temporarily convenient for itself. This prevents Turkey, of course, from getting everything it wants, because it simply is not the center of attention compared to the rest of the Middle East. And so while Turkey appears to always go a few steps forward in asserting its will, it also frequently takes a few steps back. And we see that constantly at play in its ties with everyone, while it also remains strategically reliable in as far as reliable goes in the region. In this midst, Turkey has remained a natural strategic partner to Iran and Israel. The three are never fully at ease with each other, but see each other as steadier regional powers than the core Arab states. Let's not forget that all three are severely challenged by developments in the Arab world, which systemically tries to contain Iranian power, has gone to war with Israel, and challenged Turkey with the rise of radical Islamic forces. Turkey, Iran, with Israel, have long tried to encircle the core Arab states, and throughout their common history, they've reached out to one another precisely to do that. They were early in recognizing Israel, Turkey de jure and Iran de facto. Turkey and Iran tried to form a clandestine periphery alliance with Ethiopia, actually, during the Cold War to again encircle the Arab world. And even Iran and Israel have engaged in arms dealings during the Iran-Iraq War and look at the growing voices inside Israel to preserve the nuclear deal with Iran in order to prevent the region from further disruptions. Periphery core definitions are somewhat, of course, colonial understandings of the region, and the region we all know is in a state of flux, and so these concepts will shift. But nonetheless, the three periphery states share common features too. They're strongly nationalistic compared to the Arab core, based on their Persian, Turkish, and Israel's Jewish state identity. Their armies are stronger. They're in a position to rival one another for influence in the Middle East, and beyond that, challenge the United States in a manner that the core Arab states won't. There's even a complementarity, in my view, to their rivalry. Even in high tension zones like Syria, they try not to step on each other's toes too much. Their battle is first and foremost to keep radical Islam emanating from the core Arab region from taking over. Where they have differences, they pick the battle carefully, say in handling various Kurdish parties. You could say President Erdogan is Islamist himself, but Islam and secularism have far longer history of coexisting in Turkey than in the Arab world. And even when he goes into Syria, it's mainly to keep some level of control over the Turkish-Kurdish problem. There's also an important narrative of the end of the world that bonds the periphery to each other. Shia theologians believe that the growth of Kurdish demands for nationhood and the impossibility of attaining it and the proportionality in Tehran's mind between the weakness of the Turkish army post-coup and the rising Kurdish demands all feed into the end of the world narrative, because it is predicted that by then Kurdish demands will rise. It also links Israel to Syria and the end of the world. And for those of us with religious backgrounds, we know that the end of the world is expected to happen in that territory. So how will things go forward for Turkey? Turkey is relatively consistent with Iran and Israel, but the wedges of the Arab core states are so deep now that it compromises the very stability that Turkey and Iran and Israel have strived to build as periphery states. As a result, the Arab states are fully aware of the limits of expecting Turkey to fully embrace them, and we see that, and this has come out during the coup as well. That the U.S. role is kind of hazy or phased doesn't really help, but it behooves us in the West to remind ourselves of the natural bonds that tie Turkey to Israel and Iran, which I've described, in preserving relative balance and stability in the region. Ultimately, the periphery is hesitant overplaying its hands in the Arab Middle East. The turmoil of the core Arab Middle East should be contained by them, and that is their preference. The Arab states are keenly aware of the limits of expecting Turkey to fully embrace them, and this came out again during the coup, and so Turkey will continue to engage with both the periphery and the Arabs simultaneously. But the core is also very ill-equipped to handle a weak periphery, be it Israel, Iran, or Turkey, though it feels contained by all three countries, and though it tries to unite under the Arab or GCC banner. And this basically means, therefore, that the Arabs do not have, and it's not in their favor, to see a weaker Israel, a weaker Turkey, and a weaker Iran, despite the many political differences that may exist between them. Moving forward, Turkey will remain a strategic neighbor, and even operating under the assumption that the nature of government in Turkey might alter, given the difficulties in the region and in Turkey itself, the fundamental consideration of this subsystem dynamic for the periphery states and for Turkey, which I've tried to explain, remains the same. In other words, it behooves us to consider sanctified what already works for Turkey. And this also allows for a wider balancing work that Ankara tries to do between Tehran, Tel Aviv, and the Arab world. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kanush. And thank you to all the panelists for their initial talks. I want to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Troubled Turkey. We're going to follow up with questions. We already have more than several questions from the audience. But let's track back a little bit about Erdogan, and I think these comments are reflective of opinion in general. There are those who say that because the coup has given him such wide leeway and justification to jail journalists, impose a kind of blanket situation over Turkey, that in a sense he welcomed the coup. There are even those who say that maybe he was even behind it. He had advance warning. These are some of the questions we're getting from the audience. So perhaps, Mahir, you can address those. But also, you know, part of that is, you know, Erdogan's popularity. How popular is he? Or is it, in a sense, sort of temporary sort of political popularity, as it were?
Right. Well, thank you. I'm glad that someone brought it up. One thing that the people miss in the Western media, I think, is how popular Erdogan is. He's widely popular, and one of the latest polls showed that his popularity rating is at 53%. This is the first time, perhaps, in Turkish history that the number of people who are happier under Erdogan is bigger. And although the crackdown and the level of restrictions over free speech or the judiciary or freedom of operation for most media workers is so limited, there are many people who feel that, you know, the country is being handled in a right way. This is one. Secondly, yes, I know that especially this is actually very popular in the West, in the United States. I when I talked to my American friends, they said that it seems that this coup is staged. And I'm correcting them as someone who supported the civilian government on that night. We supported the civilian politics. We told the military to go back to the barracks. And the next day, Erdogan started to shutting down our newspapers, jailing our colleagues. And as he significantly escalating the crackdown, we are now forced to believe that actually this is something that he welcomed. Actually, on that night, he called this coup as a gift from God that will allow him to do whatever he wants. And I don't believe that the coup was staged. I think it was real, and the legitimate response could be a legitimate response. But he's overstretching, and this is I actually don't know what happened on that night. And the reason I don't know is because there's no way we can challenge the official narrative. Those who challenge the official line is either losing their jobs or losing their freedom. There's no way an academic, columnist, lawyer, or journalist somehow putting an alternative view in Turkey. There's no way. You have to say that this is a coup attempt done by the Gulen movement. There's no way you can dig into deeper that. But I think this is what happened. The military establishment, one junta within the military tried to get everyone on board, and the military establishment and some other segments in the military really wanted to move forward to overthrow the government. But Erdogan, through different political maneuvering, including with the role from Russia, undermined this coup, but did not let some faction, very small faction within the military, to move forward on that night, which resulted in the death of hundreds of people. And then he used it, he exploited that to further consolidate his power. Perhaps this is the first time in Turkish history since Atatürk that a single person, consolidated so much power in his own hands. At least a decade ago, we had somewhat independent media, vibrant civil society, hostile judiciary, and intrusive military. These forces do not exist now. No checks and balances, no functioning, meaningful institutional mechanisms that would put Erdogan under check. And his path is wide open, and he just does whatever he wants with complete impunity.
Jonathan, can I comment on that?
Yeah, Jeffrey, please, go ahead.
So first of all, I agree. There's no doubt Erdogan is cheering on what's happening. It's good for him. There's also no doubt that he's incredibly popular. There was actually another poll that said he had 67% support by the public, which is by far a record. His highest before was 47% after one of the elections. But there's an important dichotomy going on which shows the nuances in Turkey, which is a good example of them. So Erdogan has the support of the public, that's true. But there's information that's been coming out, and I alluded to this earlier, that there was tacit support, if not active support, by people who were close to Erdogan, including AKP supporters, AKP politicians. Of course, you won't see this in the Turkish press, which is controlled and manipulated by Erdogan now. And so this leads to a paradox where Erdogan is the most popular he's ever been in public, but at the same time, I don't know if this is a majority policy view, but you definitely are hearing this in policy circles. Erdogan feels insecure and more alone because he does not have loyalists around him. And I think one reason this may be true is because what we've seen over the 15 years he consolidated power was that he constantly rotated advisors. One of the more recent was Davutoğlu, former prime minister. He constantly got rid of people. He didn't want people to get a strong power base on their own. And I think there's a lot of internal resentment against him. So again, this is kind of one of the paradoxes that makes Turkey challenging.
Yeah, and all three of you have brought up important issues. ISIS, of course, and the kind of tug and pull between the U.S. and Turkey over events there. One audience member reminds us that Syrian refugees are, of course, an X factor in this, and the number of refugees in Turkey from Syria is in, I believe, in the millions. But one X factor, and Dr. Kanush, you brought this up, of course, are the Kurds. Some audience members have asked about the Kurds. One question is, you know, is there a chance that there will be ever, and this has been talked about for decades now, I know, a separate independent Kurdish nation that would ever emerge? And if so, and if there isn't, how the U.S. might support that or not. Another question, actually, and I think this is a really good question, is the U.S. sincerely interested in helping the Kurds? There is that question of, the sort of proxy war, and in a sense, you know, the Kurds, using the West and the West using the Kurds because of ISIS. But can you talk about these questions, these issues, any of the panelists?
Well, I can start. it's right that the United States is partnered with Syrian Kurdish militias and also with Peshmerga and the Iraqi Kurds to fight against ISIS. And that's one of the contentious issues between Turkey and the United States and incoming Trump's presidency. We'll see how this plays out. But when you look at how the Turkish leaders and Turkish pro-government media cheered the rise of Trump and his victory, it just shows how relations were bad with the Obama administration, as despite repeated calls from Ankara that you should not arm and support the Kurdish group YPG, Syrian Kurdish militias, the United States repeatedly went and supported them, and that disturbed tremendously Turkey. But I think regarding the statehood, of course every nation has a right to have its own statehood, and we have near like a 25, 30 million Kurds in Iran, Turkey, in northern Iraq and northern Syria, and they don't have, perhaps this is the biggest, you know, group in the world that does not have any state. But if they do not get Turkey's blessing, if they establish such a group, it's very difficult to navigate in that, because they are mostly landlocked, Turkey's Kurds are living in a very bad neighborhood in terms of there are mountains, there's no river, and they don't have any natural resources. The northern Iraqi Kurdistan region is very rich with oil and gas, but they have to use Turkey to export their oil and gas. So there's no way that they can operate and get rich and actually sustain their statehood if Turkey does not allow them to establish that kind of statehood. And of course, Turkey is very worried that any kind of statehood in northern Syria and in northern Iraq would spill over and inspire their brethren in southeastern Turkey. And I think it's very important that whatever settlement they have, Turkey is on board, because without Turkey, it's going to be very difficult to preserve and sustain that state, the landlocked state, if it ever emerges.
Under international law, the right to self-determination is recognized, but the right to secession is not. And the Kurdish question fits very neatly into this issue. The Kurds have had to play the different actors against one another for the sheer fact that they are, as Mahir correctly underscored, a landlocked territory. And this has become, for good or bad, a trait of their foreign policy conduct. They work with the different regional states at different times, depending on what their interests are at that given moment. And therefore, at this given moment, you see that Turkey is reaching out to Barzani in northern Iraq. Barzanis have visited Iran to try to sort out a sort of modus operandi about how to navigate through Kurdish politics. The Syrian Kurds are dismayed by the Assad government, but at the same time, there have been moments where they've tried to also be arrive at an understanding with Assad and with Iran and with the Russians. And of course, the Kurdish problem remains the biggest threat to Turkey itself. So in my eye, there is really no prospect at this moment, given these dynamics, for a Kurdish independent state. Obviously, my heart goes out to them, and I think they deserve self-autonomy, and that's a different issue, at least as a preliminary state. But I would caution the conduct of U.S. foreign policy, be it under the Obama administration, under President-elect, future President Trump's administration. The Kurds have won favors with the West and with us because of their fight for IS, with IS, because of what they stand for. These brave, I know so many Kurdish Iranian women, so brave, they make me proud, taking, you know, fighting for their cause. But at the same time, I can tell you that the prospect of Kurdish independence feeds directly into the end of the world narrative that many Islamic forces are trying to expedite in the region. And so we must be cautious in how we deal with the prospect of Kurdish independence.
I'm going to take the contrary view. My answer to whether or not there'll be a Kurdish state is a resounding yes. I think it's just a matter of when it will happen. They've already had a de facto state for the last decade. The question of whether the southeast of Turkey will be part of that state or parts of Iran or Syria will be is another issue. But given the essentially disintegration of Iraq and disintegration of Syria, I think this hastens the prospect for eventual Kurdish state.
Thank you. I want to remind our listening audience that we're listening to a distinguished group of panelists, including you just heard Jeffrey Collins, former White House National Security Staff Director for Turkish Affairs. We also have Dr. Banavşe Kanuş, a foreign affairs expert and author of Saudi Arabia and Iran. And we have Mahir Zeynalov, a Washington, D.C.-based Turkish journalist and analyst. And we're discussing Turkey after the coup, after the July coup and the aftermath of that. One question we have, and this question has often been lost in the last few months. Turkey has requested admission into the European Union, and for a long while there have been questions of human rights issues that was raised even decades ago when there was talk of this. Those issues are still very much prominent, and I'm wondering if whether this sort of dangled carrot of, well, will you be allowed or won't you, whether that has any impact on what Turkey does under Erdogan. This is a question, partly from the audience.
Right. Well, the Turkey's membership adventure with the European Union is almost dead. I can see that in like 20, 30 years, there's almost no way that Turkey can become the European Union member. If it's not dead today, it's on life support. Definitely. But the reason why Turkey could not join the European Union in the 90s and 80s is because to be able to member of the European Union, you need to have the restricted role of military in politics, actually no role in politics. It should be put under civilian control. And because military played a tremendous role in Turkey's, in every walks of life in Turkey, they really didn't want to move forward to become the European Union member. And when Erdogan's former party was ousted by the military in 1997, so they thought that, whenever we bring, whenever we win elections, there is a military coming and just overthrowing us. So what we need to do is to expedite the process to become the member of the European Union so that we can send the military to the barracks. And that's why they launched the membership negotiations with the European Union in 2000. And as part of this process, they made sweeping political and economic reforms. But as they get rid of the military and also reform the judiciary in line with the European standards, which also limited the role of military. And because the military has a tremendous sway over the civil society and the media and the judiciary, so it was kind of like a welcoming situation for Erdogan. And as soon as he got rid of all these, you know, forces that put him under check, he started to build his own power and consolidated his electorate and power. So that's the story of the European Union. It was never ever, we thought that it was sincere, it was never ever well-intentioned. It was just a ploy by Erdogan to make sure that he has this, you know, open path to whatever he wants to be. And I think if Erdogan goes just today, if he goes today, I think it will take 5 or 10 years to rebuild that country, and it will take 5 or 10 years to be able to join the European Union. And then you will have another question if the European Union will allow, because it needs consensus. I'm sure there's Cyprus. I'm sure there are some, you know, countries that would not want Turkey in. So I think it's almost impossible that Turkey can become European Union in, like, in the upcoming 20 or 30 years.
And let me add that in the last couple of days, there have been talk about amending the Turkish constitution to allow Erdogan to be in power, I believe, till 2029.
Right.
Okay, so one question from an audience member is whether there's a future for Turkey's democratic left. And just so a little bit of context, you know, Jeffrey, you talked about the brain drain in Turkey. And I know I had the pleasure of interviewing Orhan Pamuk, the great Turkish novelist, about a decade ago. And at the time, I believe he was temporarily in the States, but now he's permanently, I believe, teaching at Columbia or another university. But he's a good example of how the kind of the massive exodus from Turkey is there any hope short term for what we could describe as Turkey's democratic left? Jeffrey,
I would say no. There are no signs that will happen. I would say 5 years ago or more, when I was living in Turkey, we started to hear secular or moderately religious friends of mine talk about leaving, but now it's actually happened. And these are, an example is a CHP, the main opposition party politician, PhD, Harvard, got his PhD at Harvard, professor in Turkey, who Mahir and I were talking about, left, and he didn't want his two daughters to grow up in Turkey, and he fears that he will be persecuted. And what's happening, you referred to this when you talked about using certain apps, but it's gotten so extreme now that the Turkish state is concocting ways to essentially blackmail people to come back to Turkey. So they will hold their relatives and do other things that are really difficult to believe. And I would agree, because of this and other things, the EU path is long been paralyzed, but now it's dead. And so I think there are just no signs, unfortunately.
I want to have for the record the fact that the Consul General of Turkey, when her hearing about this particular panel discussion, talked about, emphasized the fact that Gulen is, in their mind, a terrorist and runs a terrorist group. So... there's lots of information you can find on the Turkish consulate website and so forth. A question from the audience, though, and I think this is a good question, because we've heard a lot about the rivalry between Erdogan and Gulen, and that split happened in 2013, and now Gulen lives in Pennsylvania. But you know, what are the ideological differences? I know there was talk about Erdogan saying, well, Gulen was behind the exposure of the corruption scandal, and in a sense he blamed him for the entire scandal. But what are their ideological differences? I mean, Gulen, I believe, is a cleric, right. A moderate cleric.
Right. Well, yeah, Fethullah Gulen is a cleric living in rural Pennsylvania since 1919, when the military-backed judiciary actually filed some lawsuits against him, and he fled. He's now in a self-exiled in Pennsylvania. And he has a vast followers all around the world, and then he's claiming that he has schools in 170 countries all over the world, and more than 1,000 schools and 15 universities in Turkey, which were all shut down in the past several years. The Gulen has the idea to lift people out of poverty and promote his agenda through education. Erdogan is more political Islamist, and I think this is the main cleavage point between Gulen and Erdogan. Erdogan mostly is a populist leader, you know, targeting, you know, tapping into the anger of population, and he's riding into the flow of people who really, you know, want to be feel dignified. You know, there's one beautiful remark by Maya Angelou who said that people will forget what you did, but people will not forget how you made them feel. And I think this is the issue of the populist leaders like Trump and Erdogan and some other Brexit leaders. They really make their supporters feel dignified and empowered. And I think Erdogan, as a champion of the underdog that he was once, really is very skillful in consolidating all his, you know, people around him. I think this is a very different case when it comes to Gulen, because Gulen for 40 years invested in people for their education, and as they, you know, grow up, they now filled up all this bureaucracy and security apparatus, and there are several groups in Turkey that the Erdogan could not push them to pledge allegiance. I think the Gulen movement is one of them. And once Gulen said that actually makes sense, that Erdogan really wanted to become the emir, the leader of the world Muslims, by using his schools all around the world, and especially in the Islamic world, and because he refused, and Erdogan now started to crack down. And the crackdown in Turkey is not very similar to how it would be in Syria or in some other, you know, authoritarian countries. It's because most of the Gulenists are in the bureaucracy, are in the, have been long-time ally of Erdogan. He's really trying to, you know, purge the bureaucracy. So it's not like they are in the opposition, and he's trying to curb the opposition. And that's very messy. That family feud is so nasty, and that's why there are so many people in jail. That's why there's so much noise coming out of that. But ideological differences, I think this is that. One of them is a political Islamist who is using the Islamist rhetoric and populist rhetoric to gain more votes. And there's another cleric who has a vision for Turkey that will have a religious, conservative, educated people who will just, you know, take up positions in the state bureaucracy and in many walks of the society, and will bring, in his own view, Turkey to a world-class country.
I would underscore some of that and add a couple points. It's clear that Gulen and Erdogan were allies of convenience because they were both persecuted by the Turkish military and the Turkish state. But once Erdogan essentially consolidated power, it became, I think, somewhat of a power struggle. But I think an important point is what precipitated the actual split in 13-14. Was Gulen was criticizing Erdogan over relations with Israel and pushing Erdogan to mend ties with Israel. Erdogan, being who he is, really an autocratic one-man rule leader, he did not like hearing that and criticized Gulen, and that's really what led to kind of open warfare, where the Gulen community leaked tapes suggesting corruption among Erdogan and his allies, and then things spiraled from there.
And in fact, one question from the audience is it asks about the current state of relations between Turkey and Israel. And I know those relations, as Dr. Kanush has pointed out, have in a sense been all over the map, but also relations of convenience. And Dr. Kanush, you talked about Erdogan kind of respecting powerful leaders. But can you talk about how, I mean, a few years ago, I mean, essentially Turkey cut off all relations with Israel over the Gaza Strip and other issues. But can you talk about how, in a sense, you know, Turkey's relation with Israel is emblematic of the region in general?
That's a very good question. The region is in a state of flux and confusion, and I think there's not a single country there that's not confused. I'm not aware of President Erdogan's personality, and Jeffrey Collins did mention that, you know, the position of strength does work with President Erdogan, but I have looked at the strategic factors that shape the region and will continue to influence the region. And the way I see it is that despite the back and forth with Israel, Turkey, Iran, and Israel, and this may sound a bit absurd given the tensions tensions, particularly between Israel and Iran, but they remain and will always geographically remain on the periphery of the developments that take place in the core Arab states. And many of those developments in the Arab states will continue to threaten them. And while we see a Middle East with many shifting alliances, Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia are talking, working a little bit to contain Iran's threat more, this geography won't shift. Turkey, Israel, and Iran will have to consistently come up with ways of containing the threat from the Arab world. And at that level, Turkey has a very important role to play, because in my mind, Turkey can navigate the differences between Israel and Iran. It can navigate the differences between Iran and the Arab states. And a strong Turkey can be a balancing force in a manner that it never had the opportunity to be in the past. But of course, the region is in a state of flux, and there's a lot of undeterminance that will shape it as well.
We have a question from the audience about Zaman. Zaman is the paper that Mahir has worked for. And the question is whether, well, the question is Zaman influenced by Bakugulen? And is that one reason why it was targeted by the Erdogan government?
Well, Zaman, yes, is influenced by Gulen, but when you look at the scale of the crackdown in the past 3 months, we have 195 media outlets were shut down. In every day since the emergency rule was declared in July, 1.8 media outlets were being shuttered, and that includes, you know, 15 Kurdish media outlets too. Just 2 weeks ago, they raided a secular opposition newspaper, Cumhuriyet. So it's not only a crackdown on the Gulen movement, but of course, the Gulen movement took the biggest hit, and anything affiliated with the Gulen movement, including the newspapers and TV channels, were all shut down, 29 publishing houses. This is one part of the story, but even if someone was not being influenced by the Gulen movement, I think they would still, be shut down or at least raided, or many of its, journalists would be in jail.
There have, of course, been many suicide bombings in the last year or so in Turkey. One of them happened at the Istanbul airport in June, I believe. And that caused, rightfully so, a lot of indignation around the world, and there was a lot of analysis about what Turkey would do in response. But I'm wondering if you could talk about more about Turkey's relationship with ISIS and with Islamic fundamentalism, because in a sense it's not an easy relationship to understand. It's complicated. Erdogan has funded several militant groups in Syria, but there were those who said he actually even supported ISIS in a de facto way.
Right. Well, claiming that Erdogan supported and funded and armed ISIS, I think is irresponsible to say that. It's because I don't have any evidence. Perhaps there is. I don't have any evidence to back up this claim that he kind of like armed ISIS or supported in a direct way. But what I can say is that because Erdogan is personally obsessed with Assad, he supported every type of radical group in Syria that would be fighting against Assad. And as these rebels were frustrated with the lack of help from the West and how they could not, topple Assad, after they went to Aleppo and Damascus suburbs, they really tried to join to a bigger group called ISIS. So Turkey supported these small radical factions within Syria. Later on, they joined ISIS, and when they did, Turkey turned its face to al-Nusra Front, which endorsed al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda endorsed them, and also Ahrar al-Sham, who some of the leaders are al-Qaeda leaders too. So Turkey struck alliances with them. But another thing is that the main backbone of ISIS is the foreign fighters. And 30,000 foreign fighters, 90% of them use Turkey as a way to go to Syria. And Turkey turned a blind eye as these thousands of foreign fighters crossing from Turkey into Syria, believing that these would be a force fighting against Assad. And also, And these oil trade, Erdogan's family personally benefited, and there's lots of evidence of that, benefited from the ISIS oil trade. It sounds like, you know, Turkish officials or the customs officials going and buying, purchasing from ISIS militants. It doesn't work like that. They extract oil from ISIS-held territories, and they sell to villagers, Syrian villagers there, and they, you know, put on truck and come to Turkey and sell them. So Turkey is kind of like trading with those, you know, Syrian Arab, you know, villagers or Kurdish villagers, not directly with ISIS. But Turkey knows that the money goes to ISIS. And I think that's problematic. And they really benefited. Erdogan's family, especially his son-in-law, Berat Albayrak, personally benefited from this. So this is the complicated, intricate relationship. It's not like direct, but they really turned a blind eye. And it's not because they really wanted ISIS there. It's because they wanted a group there to fight against ISIS. And also one last remark is Foreign Minister Davutoğlu, who was then Prime Minister, himself acknowledged live on TV that we supported, you know, financially and militarily Syrian Turkmen fighters in Iraq, and later on most of them joined ISIS. So it was not like directly supporting ISIS, but supporting groups who then joined ISIS.
And in the final minutes that we have here, Jeffrey or Dr. Kanush, do you want to add anything as we leave?
I would say on ISIS, there is clear evidence that the Turkish government gave tacit support to ISIS. And essentially what they were trying to do is use that as a means to help defeat Assad and the Kurds. But what happened was it came back to bite them. So when these suicide bombings happen now, the Turkish government usually blames them on the PKK, the Kurdish terrorist organization. But in most cases, it's either not clear, or if they know it's ISIS, they're not saying. So once those suicide bombings did start, they did start to crack down on foreign fighters passing through Turkey.
Turkey's main preoccupation in Syria is the Kurdish issue and the prospect for Kurdish independence and rising Kurdish demands. And when it interferes in Syria, it has that, among other things, as one of its primary motivations. I agree that President Assad and President Erdogan may not have gotten along very well in recent years, but if you read between the lines, there have been many shifting alliances, and at some point with Turkey's sort of semi-reconciliation with Russia, we can expect some discussions with the Assad government, and that has been in play from the start in the Syrian civil war. These shifting alliances have always been over there, and Turkey has had to balance its interests with the Arab world. It has a Muslim Brotherhood sort of affiliation to watch out for. And so we look at it outside and we say, oh, this is IS and this is bad or this is good. But as both of my co-panelists said, these shifting alliances are a little uncertain for everyone to really fully comprehend. And that's all the more reason why we must, in my mind, try to preserve what's left of the strategic bonds that tie the regional states to one another.
We want to give our sincere thanks to the three panelists, Dr. Banafsheh Kanush, Jeffrey Collins, and Mahir Zeynalov. We also want to thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, your moderator for today's program, Troubled Turkey, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.